Earlier this month, an article titled The Case for Colonialism was published online in the Third World Quarterly Journal. The abstract reads, Western colonialism was, as a general rule, both objectively beneficial and subjectively legitimate in most of the places where it was found, using realistic measures of those concepts. Following its release, the publication immediately received widespread criticism, not only for its content, but also for the fact that it was published at all, despite being rejected after peer review. A petition was made rather quickly to call on the editorial team to retract the article and apologise for further brutalising those who have suffered under colonialism. The petition states that the article lacks empirical evidence, contains historical inaccuracies, and includes spiteful fallacies. There is also an utter lack of rigour or engagement with existing scholarship on the issue. The petition received 10,513 signatures, and 15 scholars have since resigned from the editorial board of the journal in protest. People have argued the writer has the right of freedom of speech, but the scholars have responded saying the piece fails to meet academic standards of rigour and balance by ignoring all manner of violence, exploitation and harm perpetrated in the name of colonialism and imperialism, and that causes offence and hurt, and thereby clearly violates that very principle of free speech. I wanted to find out more about why this article was published and who gets to determine what freedom of speech is. Mahdis Azamandi is an activist scholar who recently finished her PhD. Her research focuses on anti-racism and colonial amnesia in Aotearoa and Spain. Can you tell us a bit about the article?
So I read the article because a friend of mine that I was writing a grant application for, actually around issues of solidarity between racialized groups, he just sent me the link and said, check this out. And I just thought, okay, what is this link? So I clicked on it. And I actually had to access the Otago Library to be able to download it, which was already problematic in itself because by downloading these articles, it's good for it gives them credit. So I read it because I thought, okay, maybe the abstract doesn't really tell us what the article is about, even though it's quite explicit. And that's actually what he does. So this professor, he's a professor in political science at the State University of Portland, and he basically has a very clear stance, and he says he wants to make a case for colonialism, basically saying he has 3 points. He wants to show that it wasn't objectively harmful, and saying that it wasn't objectively harmful, but it was actually beneficial, and that it's basically being anti-colonial is like a prosperous position to take in. And he also makes this argument that colonialism wasn't really illegitimate. So he wants to prove that there is actually nothing inherently wrong with invading and dominating people as long as they give some sort of consent. So his argument is that by looking at a few cases in history, that the places that where people didn't have a strong anti-colonial stance and where they collaborated and actually gave in to colonialism that are doing much better than places where colonialism ended because of strong anti-colonial movements, but that now have fallen into places that are highly impoverished and like rogue states, as some political science like to say in quotation marks. And within all of this, he doesn't draw at all on any academic knowledge around colonialism, anti-colonialism, and of course, colonial attitudes that continued even though colonial administration was over. So he basically says that, first of all, not only wasn't colonialism really bad in the past, he's actually making an active claim for the West to go back and colonize and recolonize certain places. Of course, he does admit that, you know, people should give consent, but that, of course, is also highly problematic. And basically, the article is really poorly researched. So one of the biggest problems with it is that it actually probably didn't even make it through peer review. So most journals, well-established, recognized journals, force you through blind peer review, at least 2 reviewers. So it's already debated, and that's, of course, I don't have evidence if that was the case or not. People say that it actually didn't go through peer review. It was rejected in the peer review, and then the journal decided to go ahead with the publication. So the first problem is that scientifically, it's flawed. So scientifically, this article should have never been published. Now, the other problem with it is, there's lots of layers of problems to this, is the particular journal that it was published in, and it's the Third World Quarterly.
So some people have had issues now with the name of the journal, but that's a whole different story. So it was founded at a time where this term was actually appropriated by people who were from the so-called third world. So it was a journal that was founded to give voice to positions that were usually marginalized in the academic world. It was founded under the values of contesting colonial attitudes and imperial attitudes. So what makes this article publication so highly problematic was that it was given a space within a journal that actually was founded to challenge these dominant narratives. So it's not that these kinds of articles don't circulate, but the fact is that a lot of other journals, mainstream dominant journals, could have given this article an outlet, even though it's highly problematic and not scientifically accurate. So it's problematic and scientifically incorrect in some ways, and it was published in a journal that was actually formed to give people who question colonialism and imperialism a voice. So these are, I think, some key issues to consider. And then, of course, it comes out at a time where we are already seeing a resurgence of white supremacist movements, and I think, yeah, people are coming forward with it, with their ideas in a way that goes uncontested. And now, of course, people have called the journal to take the article down and issue an apology. And the response has been divided. So, of course, there's lots of people, in particular, people from former colonized countries and people of color, academics of color, but of course also many other academics, because it is such poorly researched article. And the response has been that a lot of people feel the article should not be taken down because it's freedom of speech and we need to have a debate around certain issues. First of all, a lot of people who say this haven't actually read the article. And second of all, it's actually not at all problematic. It's not censorship to ask a journal to stick to the values that it was created under. So it's not problematic to say, hey, you stand for this, yet you've gone and published something that is actually counter all the ideals and values that you're set to promote. And also, there is supposed to be a structure within academia of holding academics accountable. So academia is not you can say whatever you want, and then we debate that. Actually, that questions the very science of knowledge production. So in some ways, I think this article reveals how colonial Western academia continues to be, not that we didn't know that it was colonial, but how colonial it continues to be, but also how a lot of liberals don't understand that the impact of such knowledge production is very different for colonized people than it is for non-colonized people. So for non-colonized people, this becomes an issue of free speech. And for colonized people, this is not an issue of free speech. This is an issue of promoting or justifying genocide. So I think it's really interesting of how a lot of people approach the issue of colonialism, because it would be very clear if this was an article that maybe in some way diminished the atrocities of the Holocaust. People wouldn't say you should leave it up because of freedom of speech, but yet 500 years later we can somehow still debate whether colonialism was objectively harmful or not. So I think it does say something about the mentality, not just of academics, but of society as a whole. And that's why it's so important to support, I think, the petition, because the petition is not just about remove this article and then we're all happy. It's about, okay, we need to really seriously engage with these structures and question them and see how is this actually still possible, and why is there not a way for us to verify, was this article really rejected in the peer review, and if it was rejected, how come it was published? And how come publishers today, in a journal that was founded by anti-colonial academics, how come these venues are so co-opted? Because it's so much easier to publish an article like this than, let's say, publish an article where you use non-Western methodologies, whether that is indigenous methodologies or not. So
when you say easier, do you mean it's easier to literally just get into a journal?
Well, because you constantly have to justify your knowledge as knowledge, right? Because the way colonialism worked, one of the ways that was key of how colonialism works is to put the rationality of colonized subjects in question. So not only did it say, okay, you're savage beings, you're animal-like, et cetera, but one of the key factors was that you weren't thought of as somebody who could think, right? As somebody who could be rational, as somebody who could actually produce knowledge. And that legacy, I think, is constantly restructured in different ways. So until today, if you are not following Eurocentric ways of knowledge production, you first have to justify of why that is still empirical, of why you're still able to prove a point, of why that is knowledge, why that is not just an opinion, why that is not just about feelings. So it is a lot easier to publish a journal a journal article that is about like positivist science or quantitative data, because we still understand certain types of knowledge to be more valuable and more precise. So with this article, what's so striking about it is that even according to these Eurocentric Western standards, it is scientifically inaccurate because it doesn't draw on the vast body of literature that exists on this issue. So you don't even have to be an anti-colonialist to be able to show and demonstrate the flaws in the article. But I think the biggest critique now has been the people who are signing these petitions or who came up with the petition is related to where was this published, like what venue was this published in, what kind of message are you sending, and what are you trying to normalize with these kinds of articles? We need to hold people accountable. I don't think it's about censorship to try to hold people accountable for what they say and do. And to all the people who are such staunch defenders of freedom of speech, I mean, freedom of speech is not that you can basically deny all other rights of people in the name of you being able to say whatever you want to say, because it doesn't just stay in the realm of the spoken and the written. So it's not just discursive. Like, this actually has tangible material impacts on people's lives. So colonialism is not something, you know, that was just this phenomenon that happened hundreds of years ago, but that didn't affect and continues to impact people's life chances. So when people say, oh, just leave it up, it's good for intellectual debate, I just wonder, how can you want some intellectual debate when you're talking about people's access to resources and people's life chances here? Because the first thing that colonialism does is to limit people's life chances. Genocide is not something that is just an intellectual exercise. So this is what's really problematic about it. And yeah, I think what's so incredibly infuriating is that it comes out in this particular kind of journal. Now, I don't want to say that within academia some places are free of oppression and they're perfect safe spaces, but I think it's totally acceptable to ask for accountability and transparency, because these mechanisms are supposed to be in place. So peer review is a mechanism of quality control, if you like, and I mean, academia is supposed to have validity. You're supposed to speak to some kind of evidence that you have, which is also not given in this article. And then the other question is, why are we giving platform to these ideas? It's not. If this was an opinion that doesn't circulate and we want to have debate with an isolated minority opinion, then maybe that could be understandable. But actually, this is a mainstream opinion. It's not like white supremacists don't have outlets. They actually have plenty of outlets. The question then is, should we give them more outlets to spread their ideas? And what is the responsibility of reviewers? What is the responsibility of editors? What's the responsibility of colleagues? And what's the responsibility of institutions of facilitating this type of knowledge production?
So, like you said, it is a mainstream position. That narrative that he's talking about isn't a new one. A large number of people still believe some of those ideas that he talks about. What is the agenda? Why is this? I mean, we've talked obviously about why it's been published and or how, but whose agenda is it serving?
With colonialism in particular, I find it really striking of how it's just a short-term memory for people. They have such a distorted vision of it. And I think it's not necessarily that everybody wakes up with a particular agenda of how they want the world to be, because I don't know this academic very well in his work. I know he's highly problematic. But I think it has a lot to do with a lack of historical education, and that is not accidental. I do think that that's very actively created. So people have very little knowledge if you're not necessarily a historian that works on these types of issues. So there is this absence of this willful suppression and information about colonial history, and in particular about the atrocities of colonial history. But also, there is a disconnect between colonialism in the past and today, and I think that's the biggest problem, and I think this is what's really evident in the article. So he says, here we have states that used to be formerly colonized, and they are struggling with poverty, they're struggling with poor governance, they're struggling with corruption. There is no understanding of how, just because colonialism's administration ended, that all forms of colonial attitude in it. So like this idea of coloniality that some people refer to, right? Like the way we think, the way we do things, the way our economic system works. All of that still has traces of that very colonial administration, just with a different name, right? So I think this is what people don't see often, how like colonialism lingers. In some places, it's really alive and well and kicking. And in some places, it's more, you need to scratch the surface to actually see these structures, how they're still in place. And I think that's one of the biggest problems. And the other problem is that I think people never, like, we didn't have decolonization as such. And decolonization, in his case, would probably be, like, to look at himself and his position. Where am I thinking from? Right? I think academics never have to think of themselves, where am I actually standing from, where am I thinking, is my position a subjective position, because they assume this bird's eye view of objectivity, of knowing everything and knowing everything in terms of like emotion-free, value-free. And of course I think for non-European thinkers that is very different, because you're constantly told that you're specific, that you're different, that you're particular, that you're thinking will always reflect that, like you always understand that you're thinking from a particular space. So he doesn't necessarily say, I'm thinking from this particular space, I'm thinking from the space of a settler in the United States with a particular background, having been brought up in a particular institution, and that's the history that I'm reproducing. So maybe, I don't even want to say he's not aware of it, because I think this is very deliberate. I do think it's a very active ignorance. It's an actively perpetuated ignorance, because you have to keep yourself ignorant, right? So I always think to myself, if I'm not a doctor, a medical doctor, and I don't understand the details of the disease of cancer as a normal person, well, that's a type of ignorance that is understandable, because I don't necessarily have access to that knowledge, but I can acquire it. Now, with something like colonialism, if you live in a country that is a settler colony like the United States, you don't have to actually look very far. And people have been and are contesting these histories all the time. We have the internet, we have textbooks, we have history books. So this is a different type of ignorance. So this is you being given correct information and choosing to not look at it, choosing not to believe it, choosing to go back and believe this other very narrow understanding of history. So I think it is an ignorance, but it's a very willful ignorance.
How should this be challenged within academia, or should it be challenged outside of it?
I think it should be challenged outside and inside academia. I think it should be challenged with people knowing what they're challenging. So I think we should not fall into these tropes of not panicking about articles like that, because they aren't actually the exception. This one's particularly bad, but they aren't the exception. I think it's about holding the journal accountable, and holding the journal accountable by saying, look, this is what you started off as, and this is who's on your editorial board. I mean, some incredible thinkers, you know, non-white thinkers are on the editorial board of this journal, and they also have spoken out against this article. So I think it's doing that. And holding the universities accountable, and I think holding the universities accountable is actually goes way beyond this one article, right? So if you have academics like this in your institution, what signal, you know, what are you saying is normal? What are you saying is acceptable? What kind of values are you promoting? And what type of knowledge production, what kind of science are you actually advocating for? So I think that's really important. And of course, beyond the institution, holding our governments accountable for actually addressing colonial history. So I think there is lots of layers. But in terms of just the article, I think the petition that calls for it to be removed from the journal, and they want a response from the journal, I think that's maybe the most basic demand people could have. But I think the problem is far bigger than just this article. As I said, the problem is that now you have liberal academics who defend the article in the name of freedom of speech, which I think is also problematic.
What's been your personal experience in academia in terms of these attitudes?
I think my personal experience is it's never been that blatant. I think the biggest problem for me in academia was the very subtle notions of, I think, oppressive behavior, whether that was, and I think the most striking ones in the academia are like subtle sexism and subtle racism. Now, I'm an able-bodied person, so of course I'm privileged in that sense, but I think there's also a lot of ableism within the university. And just in terms of, I think, physical access and how places are designed and so on. But to speak of very subtle racism, I think a lot of people are committed in terms of what they say, and they will think of themselves as very tolerant, liberal beings, which I'm sure they actually are convinced of in their heads. But I think what the actions and the representation and the types of, I think, learning that is facilitated and knowledge that is presented actually reveals that there is some lingering, or maybe not so lingering, racism in the air. So I think for me most striking was when I started at the University of Otago, and yeah, I guess people can hear by my accent, I'm not from New Zealand, was the underrepresentation of Māori academics. So not only are there very few Māori academics, but I think biculturalism isn't necessarily always reflected in how studies are set up and what you are taught. So I was lucky that I did my research partly on Aotearoa New Zealand, so I had to learn, so which was good for me. But I think you can actually come as an international student, you can come here and not be exposed if you don't want to, because it's not necessarily encouraged. And if it's encouraged, I think sometimes it has this very tokenistic approach to what it means, you know, to appropriate tikanga Māori for whatever reason. So I think, to me, I would have expected to see more staff. And apart from seeing more staff, seeing more, I think, classes with Indigenous methodologies, questioning the very Eurocentric apparatus that the university is. So I think that was quite, yeah, it was difficult. And I think as a woman of color in university, you're constantly questioned anyway. I always said, you know, people think they do research, I do me-search, because I do things that are kind of related to me, and that's why they can kind of look down on my research, because it's kind of a personal journey. And I just think, well, you know, if racism doesn't affect you, then you should question your understanding of the world, because it does affect you, it just benefits you. But it's that attitude, this very subtle subconscious attitude of questioning some people's research. And I just think, yeah, just looking at the experiences of students as well within the university, and I can only speak to the experiences of a student because I haven't actually been a faculty member in a university here. Well, in New Zealand, that is. So I think people make different experiences, and I know just talking to peers who are male and white, that when I would talk about my experiences and they would talk about their experiences, it was like we worked in two different departments. So I think and that's important. It's not me questioning his experience, because I mean their experiences are just as real and just as valid, but they happen at the same time while other experiences happen. And it's precisely that intersection between these, you know, very positive and very easy experiences and those where people struggle, where people question, where people feel very alienated within the institution.
Is there anything you want to add?
I think I want people who are privileged, who have less to lose, because some of us have more to lose, to actually use their position to speak. Because it's very draining for people to basically be like a broken record, to repeat and repeat and repeat, but also you actually risk so much more. And it's not like, I think Indigenous and people of color academics aren't marginalized enough. So I think for people who hold secure positions, who are in dominant positions, whether it's because they're male or because they're white, they should use that. And it doesn't take much. It just takes, you know, saying, well, I don't think this is okay, or disrupting what's happening. And I think people to come and speak up and say, hey, let's be very rational here. This is not a matter of freedom of speech. I think the problem is the layers of this, and people who just want to address one of these layers don't understand how, I mean, people don't really want to understand how this impacts people's lives. They just think, oh, this is just an article, you know, this is just a few words on a piece of paper or on the screen somewhere that has no tangible impact on people's lives. And I think that's the biggest danger, and that's the biggest threat. Because, of course, what we produce in the university has lived, tangible, material impact on people's lives. The West really needs to have a very critical look at how the notion of freedom of speech is mobilized and who does it serve, who does this protect. When people say Black Lives Matter, then people feel that they have to correct them on saying all lives matter, as if they were somehow excluding other people from this notion of Black Lives Matter. And now when people say this on, let's say on TV, or there was the case of a university professor that walked into her class wearing a BLM t-shirt, so it just said BLM, and there was huge backlash from her students that, you know, she was promoting, you know, hate speech, and that it was, I don't know exactly what the criticism was. And then I wonder, where are the people? And I think it shouldn't be defended through freedom of speech, but then people don't argue, oh, you also have a freedom of speech to say these particular types of political, expressive political positions. So I also find it really interesting when freedom of speech is mobilized, right? Another case was the Palestinian scholar who tweeted against Israel's raid on Gaza. He tweeted something and he lost his job. Right. So, and then people also say, you know, like, what type of, who has freedom of speech? And then, of course, he went to court and he won his case. But it's really problematic of how notions of freedom of speech are used. I think academic freedom is crucial. Academic freedom is key, and we need to be able to debate controversial ideas and conflicting ideas. But first of all, they need to be properly researched. But we should never debate whether or not genocidal politics are justified. I think some things you don't need to debate, you know, because if by debating them, you're opening them up to normalization. And I think this is what makes this article so problematic, right? Like he's advocating for recolonization if people give consent, and he bases that on one person he has heard. He says, you know, he went to Mozambique, and one person said to him, oh, when are they coming back? And this is kind of one of the evidence, like pieces of evidence he uses.
That was his justification.
I mean, there's lots of other things he says, and he draws on references that he has somewhere, but he doesn't contrast them to, I mean, an immense body of literature that proves them otherwise. So if he was engaging all this other literature that exists and argued against point by point. Yes, maybe then you could have had a point, but then it would become very hard to prove that colonialism was objectively good. And that's what he says, right? Like, he's trying to prove that it wasn't objectively harmful. But we shouldn't just accept everything in the name of debate. I mean, also, debate is a privilege. Sitting there and debating your humanity, I don't know if that's something I want as an intellectual exercise, you know. And I think privileged people don't understand that. For them, it's an intellectual exercise, but for other people, it's basically saying, "Hey, I am human. Hey, you need to understand that I'm human." They don't have to prove their humanity to anybody. They can just sit around the table and discuss whether or not they agree. But they don't understand that a colonized person sits at the table and has to first prove, "Oh, hey, actually, I'm also a person." So nobody, I don't think that we should ask people to constantly have to convince other people of their own humanity.